I'd like to welcome Michael Huey to Michigan Writers on the Air. Michael is an artist and writer who divides his time between northern Michigan in the summer and Vienna, Austria in the winter. Today we will be talking about his book, Straight as the Pine, Sturdy as the Oak. It is the history of the early years of Camp Leelanau for Boys, the Leelanau School, and the homestead in Glen Arbor. It's an incredible piece of work running more than 500 pages, with hundreds of photographs and a beautifully crafted narrative. Michael, how did you get started on this project?
I began collecting family materials when I was a fairly young boy. I grew up on site at the homestead until about my 10th year. And I began to find different ways as I grew older to work with the materials I had. Later on in life, I began to use them in my profession.
Yeah, you are a working artist, and that certainly comes through in this book.
My work as an artist is conceptual. I'm trained in German language and literature. I did my undergraduate degree in German language and literature at Amherst College. I worked for a few years at the Christian Science Monitor in Boston in journalism. And then I went to Vienna in 1989. I'd been an exchange student there, and I went with a fellowship to continue graduate study. Eventually got my master's degree in art history from the University of Vienna. And that combination out of that combination, I developed my artistic practice, which has much to do with the topics loss, legacy, and the archive. So broadly speaking, it's about memory.
You begin the book with the epigraph, "The organized summer camp is the most important step in education that America has given the world." Here you're quoting President Emeritus Charles Eliot of Harvard, who was a 19th century educational reformer. The unique beginnings of Camp Leelanau, how did it start? What was the concept behind it and the personalities behind it?
Well, that quote to begin with is actually a quote of a quote. It was used in one of the early promotional brochures for the camp, one of the brochures from the 1920s. I thought it interesting. It's a little old-fashioned sounding, and I put it in just the way it was. The camp has a complicated and unique story. I like to. When I'm telling this story, I actually like to begin with the thought that it all goes back in a way to an act of kindness on the part of Skipper Beals in 1921. He was an educator. He'd been educated in education, so to speak. He was trained at the University of Oregon and at Washington University in St. Louis and at the University of Chicago. He was there at a time when progressive educational reform was
in vogue. It was the thing.
Exactly. It was also his great interest. He became a teacher at a Christian Science boarding school in St. Louis, Principia, as did my great aunt, Cora Motz Beals, his wife. And in the school year 1920-21, at Principia, there was a smallpox outbreak, and a number of boys, 17 boys, were sent into quarantine to a house, a large country house out in the Ozarks. They were there on their own. They were being taken care of by a cook and other staff, but Skipper began, because I think it was his nature to think in this way, he began to be concerned about the boys, and he requested and was given permission to go and visit them there. And when he got there, he found that they were actually not doing very well. Their spirits were low, they were falling behind in their studies, they didn't have enough to do, they were bored. And so he again requested and received permission to stay and decided to try to find ways to not only to help the boys with their studies. He was a teacher in U.S. history, in Latin, and in algebra, geometry. But also to find amusements for the boys. And he was very gifted at that, at finding ways to help them learn through doing amusing things. So he stayed for the rest of the semester. And at the end of the semester, the boys either were still required to stay there or they decided to stay at that house for the summer. And they had their first session of camp, so to speak, at this house in the Ozarks in the summer of 1921. The following year, the boys, after the school year, again asked, that was so much fun, could we do that again? Skipper thought about it for a little bit and decided, yes, we could. And he found a place on Lake Michigan. He said, we'll go north this time. He found a place near Grand Haven on the beach, a camp called Windy Dune. And there, the summer of 1922 and 1923, they ran, again, the summer camp. And the interesting thing about those camp beginnings and also the camp beginnings when they finally did arrive up here on Sleeping Bear Bay is that there was that educational aspect to it. It was classes in the morning, and then they would do fun things in the afternoon.
And as you look through the early parts of the book, the photographs are just remarkable and wonderful. It is country that we all love, the beaches, the dunes, sailing, playing tennis, archery, everything.
And for me personally, it's not just that the landscape is country that I love, but photography itself is country that I love. And that is really my great interest in, and was my great interest in putting together this book, which originally should have been about a 250-page book. It went to well over, or just over 500 pages, but it was hard to stop when I had this wonderful photo material to work with.
So Skipper Beale's unique qualities as an educator.
Skipper had, according to the memories of some who knew him, a unique approach, and he was someone with a, it's been said of him that he had a great brightness of outlook. He was for informality in the classroom. He was for an interest-driven curriculum and for hands-on learning. He found unique ways to have fun with the boys and also unique ways when it was necessary to punish the boys. He was a very good motivator. Mm-hmm. He could, in effect, get the boys to do what he wanted them to do.
It's interesting how you put the book together because you have, as I've mentioned, the ones wonderful photographs, but you also quote from letters and journals and various other material to tell this story.
It's a family history at the same time.
When I was thinking about this, it's sort of memoir, but it's not quite your memoir because you weren't alive yet, but you do create a memoir because you take all of this other material.
And I addressed that in my introduction, the fact that, in fact, the time frame for this book is 1921 to 1963. I was alive during none of that. I was born in 1964. But It was a very difficult book to organize because it's so complicated. Part of my motivation for writing it was to talk about these three institutions as a unity, which they were, the one having grown out of the other. And for decades, they ran successfully side by side as family businesses. That was the one thing. The other thing was to talk about the lives of four remarkable individuals. William M. Skipper, as he was known, Beals, his wife Cora Motts Beals, who was my great aunt, my grandmother, her sister, Helen Motts Huey, and my grandfather, Arthur S., known as Major Huey. They were related this way and that. They were related through blood, through marriage, and I think most of all through common purpose. But interestingly, the men were connected as well because Major had come to Leelanau in 1929. He was a member of Skipper's first counselor training class, and Major was somebody who was extremely gregarious, outgoing, athletic. He had a very winning personality, and I think someone who was always picked first to be on whatever team. And Skipper, in effect, picked him, and he became Skipper's protege and over the years his right-hand man, and eventually he was to take over, after Skipper's death, to take over the entire operation.
You mentioned three interconnected institutions, Would you talk about those? The camp, the school, and the homestead.
Well, continuing from what I began to explain before about the history of the camp, in 1923 then, at the end of the summer 1923, Skipper and Cora were married, and they decided to look for a permanent location for this summer camp. They wrote letters to friends and relatives and decided to take a tour around the lake. And one of the sites they looked at was the site at the mouth of Crystal at the mouth of the Crystal River on Sleeping Bear Bay. They eventually, of course, bought that site in the fall of 1923. They were very quick at deciding to do things. And the following summer, they held their camp there. Meanwhile, Skipper's sister had invited his sister to begin a girls' camp. And that is the beginning of Camp Kohana. Mm-hmm. So you have those two things happening sort of at the same time.
And there were no coeducational camps back then. They could be close together, but only so close.
Exactly. It's the concept of the sister camp, yes. Which is just far enough away not to be able to reach by foot.
Exactly.
But going on then, the camp continued then through the 1920s. And as I say, it was still a place where there was tutoring in the summer, tutoring in a variety of subjects. And where there was also a kind of a work program. Students could earn their way through the camp. That became important later for the school. The school began in 1929, an ominous year. At the end of summer session, the summer camp session of 1929, several campers approached Skipper and Cora and begged them, really, to allow them to stay with them up north that winter. Now, until that time, Skipper and Cora had also only been there in the summer. They were still living in St. Louis in the winters. And they again made an on-the-spot decision to go ahead with this. And in September 1929, they had plans drawn up for the homestead building, for the original homestead building, and construction began on it. It was based on sketches by Aunt Cora. And amazingly, the building was finished enough so that they could move into it by the middle of November that year. Now, you have to remember, at the same time, there was a certain pressure on them to be able to move into it because the boys, until that time, were sleeping in the same army tents they slept in the summertime on the beach. Those were army tents that had a wooden floor, and they were there until the middle of November that year. And out of that, then, also in the middle of the 30s, grew the homestead as a resort, a hotel and as a resort. It was a natural outgrowth again. When parents would come up to pick up children, they wanted to know where they could stay. In the early years, they were recommended another place to stay. That place burned down, and it just happened that
Yes. Now, this is a very large book. It's a very expensive book. How did you go about getting it in print?
Well, as I said, the book became larger as I was working on it, and I became dimly aware that it was going to be an extremely expensive project for me. Publishing nowadays is often such that one is expected to bring a finished book, an edited book, a layouted book, a book with all of its rights secured and all of its captions, everything, including the financing. And as I became aware of what that financing was going to be, it was clear to me that I was going to have some kind of fundraising for the book. And I was able to do a Kickstarter crowdfunding for the book that was successful, fortunately. And I don't see any reason not to say it. A book like this, a big hardcover book on very high quality paper with offset printing, and this production, for printing and layout costs alone, costs about $42,000. That's what I spent. That's not my time. Mm-hmm. That's not my work.
Yes.
I worked on it for a year as a full-time job. That's for free.
Yeah.
But the actual costs were about that.
Before you had printed one copy.
Right. Well, as the first copy was being printed. And the Kickstarter crowdfunding financed about half of that, which was wonderful. A lot of people gave very generously, and I was thrilled to see that come in too.
Well, these three institutions produced a huge number of memories for thousands of families. I can see why they would support it. Michael, would you like to read from this book?
I'd be happy to. I'd like to read from my introduction, which has the title, The Chain in the Tree. When Skipper, Cora, Helen, and Major first came to Leelanau in the 1920s, they arrived by steamer. Roads were rough, none paved. A spirit of adventure and of pleasure gained through improvising and figuring things out for oneself marked these early years. At the same time, theirs was a cultivating instinct. Helen later remarked, "I was not a camper. I liked picnics on screened porches." Her eldest sister, Cora, was of a similar mind. The roads of memory, too, are rudimentary, and they lead through a kind of wilderness of their own. For decades, I have sought my bearings in this backcountry. It is the setting of my working life, and therefore, to a degree, my daily life, and I have become a fairly proficient frontiersman and pathfinder in it. My family may have wondered, just as my grandfather's parents wondered about him, at my setting off into these wilds as a young man. What is he looking for? And when is he coming back? For me, the past is in some ways the freest place, as free as early 20th century Leelanau must have been for these recent forebears. Its remoteness requires making do with what's at hand and displaying a little ingenuity. If one is clever and adept, however, its abundant raw materials can be fashioned into something new and useful, and perhaps beautiful. Born in September 1964, I was de facto not in Leelanau or anywhere else during the period 1921 to 1963, the entire time frame of this book. But does the autumn know nothing of the summer it follows? My point being that when I came along, life at camp, at the school, and at the homestead was a logical continuation of what it had been for the past 40 years or more. I was steeped in it from birth. We lived on site year-round, and some of my most deep-seated memories are from the off-seasons. When thick, heavy snowflakes fell around the homestead on quiet December afternoons, with a fire burning in the fireplace of the building's lobby, and Major and my father, each at work in his office, it simply intensified the feeling I always had anyway of being tucked in under the shelter of Prospect Hill. There, more or less alone, with the hill behind us and the Crystal River, its dune, and Sleeping Bear Bay before us, our lives seemed as complete and as safe as they possibly could be. Now and then others were in peril. During the winter, we might be called upon to help clear a heavily drifted stretch of Thorson Road for the bakers, who cared for the animals at Circle H, and were sometimes snowed in for days on end. There were occasional dramas with students rafting out into Lake Michigan on ice floes, but our own existence, we believed, was secure. My brother Dick and I knew every detail of our grandfather's principality, its laws and mores, so much at odds with those of the outside world. And we were the exceptions within that exceptional world, the children who were not on vacation there, not necessarily in camp, and not in boarding school. I recall returning home on the bus from the local public elementary school one particular sunny, warm, early spring afternoon around 1974, riding past Glen Haven and through Glen Arbor, and finally being dropped off at the Leelanau School's turnaround, whence Dick and I walked the short distance north back along the river to our home near its mouth. It was a sublime, blue-skied day, with snow melting away and icicles dripping from the eaves of the buildings. The warmed ground gave off a fertile, mossy scent. Everything would soon be growing. With the lake colder than the air, a long, low, spotlessly white fog bank had formed between South Manitou Island and Sleeping Bear, and like a great wave was slowly rolling in. Whenever I think back to this day of crystalline clarity, with clouds beginning to form out on the horizon, something in me catches. Everything changed when I was 10 and we left this place. For me, it was like going into an exile from which there could be no return. The exiled, gather a few portable valuables that, if they are lucky, they are not forced to abandon along the way. But the last thing they clutch are the photograph albums. And so for me, too, the photographs became the most important thing. I collected them and explored them the way I had earlier surveyed the woods and the riverbanks, and they gradually relinquished their secrets, just as those sites once had. From my earliest years, I experienced the world through a kind of filmic gaze, and in many of my interactions with my parents, grandparents, great-aunts, and great-uncles, the cameras were rolling, so to speak. I listened intently to their stories, instinctively committing them to memory, as one would who knew he would require this information later, perhaps to find a way back after all. At times, the data literally seemed to be strewn along the path like crumbs. I retrieved Aunt Cora's earliest Leelanau album from the paper basket one day in 1989. Her life was nearing its completion, and letting things go, she had undertaken a final tour of the county. I had watched from a distance as she gently placed the book in the basket in what I interpreted as a mixture of typical modesty and trust that her life's work would continue to unfold as it should, album or no album. Increasingly, historical documents and records, in addition to photographs and films, scrapbooks, yearbooks, and all manner of further memorabilia, accrued to me in ways like these, often as serendipitous as they were surprising. With each new edition came a new obligation to put things in their proper place. On a moonlit night in the summer of 2003, my father poured Major's ashes through my hands and into the Crystal River. The rapid current whisked them away, creating in the darkness an unexpected flume of white, a rune writ on the river, a farewell flourish. Later, after we put Helen's ashes there too, we learned that Cora's family had done the same thing with hers, at the very same spot. Unwittingly, we cousins had reunited the trio in this resting place, not far from their neighboring homes on the beach. This work, too, is born of the twin compulsions to collect and to disperse. Long ago, in among the grand red oaks in front of the old homestead building, there used to be a particular specimen. This tree stood midway between the south end of the homestead and the fish house, just at the point where the paths crossed and the view over the lawn opened tantalizingly toward the lake. In an earlier era, there must have been a gate set up at this position, allowing the road to be cordoned off by a heavy iron chain. The chain was still attached by one of its ends to the oak. At some point, when this security was no longer deemed necessary, the chain had been drawn back and tossed up over the crook of the tree. Resting there, then, unused and untouched for decades on end, the chain was finally absorbed into bark, cambium, and sapwood as the tree grew up around it. By the time of my childhood, this chain, an object of great fascination to me, with its links running into and out of the wood, could no longer be extricated from the mighty oak. The chain in the tree has everything to do with who I am and what this book is.
Thank you. Michael Huey reading from Straight as the Pine, Sturdy as the Oak. Michael, when you started on this book, who was the intended audience?
I think in a certain sense, the intended audience is always myself.
Okay.
I'm very often working on things that are very emotional things to me. And in this case, the experience, as I've just described it also, of having to leave a place left a kind of hole in my heart. And that has become, over the years, a source also. And I find that when I'm working on something, be it in the arts or when I'm working on a local history project, that it's almost like walking through a landscape. And the closer I get to this source, the closer or the more certain I am that I'm getting to the place where I want to be. It's a very personal journey working on a book like this.
And I'm sure in the last year you've been contacted by readers who have gone through this book. I'm sure if I were connected to these three institutions, I would be tied to it. But just as someone who lives in this area, it is such a wonderful history of the last 100 years. The institution is tied to the place.
one of the advantages, one of the odd advantages, in a way, of having had a European publisher, and I do, I have a Viennese publisher for this book. He's published other books of mine. His name is Johannes Schleebrugge. And I approached him with this idea originally just as a way to be fair. I said, look, Johannes, I'm working on a new book. It's nothing for you. It's about local history on Sleeping Bear Bay in Michigan, so I'm sure you don't want to do it. But of course, I'd be happy to show it to you. And so I did show it to him, and he didn't think long about it before saying, I don't know why you would say that. I'm very interested in this book. I definitely want to publish this book. It's made it a little tricky with distribution and that sort of thing.
I would think.
But it was helpful to me, to get back to your question, it was helpful to me in terms of thinking about it not just from a local perspective. In other words, in looking at it as a cultural phenomenon, in looking at it as Americana, in looking at it as the history of vernacular and professional photography during this period. In other words, in approaching the book from the standpoint of someone who knew nothing about the area, someone far away, a European who, in looking through it, would also have to find something of interest.
I think so. It's a lovely book. Where is it available?
It's in local bookstores.
Okay.
And I ask people to go there first.
We applaud that.
It's also online. I'm sure people are able to find it online.
There is a lot out there about you. You have a gorgeous website, michaelhuey.com, and you have a Facebook account that is kept up with regular contributions.
I work hard at that. I'm someone who works for himself, and as an independent artist and writer, I understand that I have to keep those things up, that it's an important part of my work. And in fact, it's a kind of advantage that I think I also have, because I'm an organized person and I'm somebody who doesn't mind doing things like that. And I know there are a lot of colleagues of mine who really despise work like that. And I find that it's, in fact, you know, when people think, oh, he's an artist, and try to imagine what my days are like, I know that they probably skip about two-thirds of what I actually have to do, which is logistics and organization and shipping, very banal,
yes,
boring things.
Yes. So your Facebook account is?
On Facebook, if you type in artist Michael Huey, you'll come to my artist page on Facebook, which is a public page that people can like, and I hope they will.
Okay, and it's H-U-E-Y, Michael Huey.
Correct.
Michael Huey, thank you so much for being here.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.